Diane and I this week, we were watching television, and we came upon this series on Netflix called World War II in Color. World War II in Color. And the basic premise of this show was that they took the existing black and white footage of World War II, and they ran it through the colorization process. However they do that, I imagine they probably either hand paint or computer paint each single frame of these images so that when you watch them, now it looks like you're looking at the like World War II in color. They then take that film and then they use it as history, you know, as a backdrop to the history that they're explaining, you know, as they're doing. And it's pretty fascinating history, and it makes it more current somehow when you're seeing it in color rather than black and white. I think what it is, you don't associate color with being old-fashioned or not relevant, but when you have it in color, it seems more relevant somehow. So it was really fascinating. We kind of binge-watched it for a couple days until it got to the part about the extermination of the Jews, and we had to stop for a while because that was getting a little rough to watch. But it was fascinating history. And when we were thinking about World War II or watching this series, it was truly a global war. I mean, it was a bloody it was a global war. Almost every country in the world either directly participated in the war or declared war on another country during that time. A lot of them at toward the end of the war, they declared war on the Axis powers, Germany, Japan, and Italy. But it's fascinating to see every aspect. They kind of covered every aspect of World War II, all the fronts, you know, the Pacific, the Italy region, North Africa, Japan, all those aspects were covered. So yeah, it was fascinating. I'm going to give you a little quiz about the time of that, a little bit of a quiz. This was said by somebody on November 11th, 1948, 3 years after World War II ended. And I'm going to give you a quote and see if you can identify who said this quote. The quote goes, "We have men of science, too few men of God. We have grasped the mystery of the atom and rejected the Sermon on the Mount. The world has achieved brilliance without conscience. Ours is a world of nuclear giants and ethical infants. We know more about war than we know about peace, more about killing than we know about living. If we continue to develop our technology without wisdom or prudence, our servant may prove to be our executioner." Anybody know who said that? Was it a poet maybe? Like maybe a religious leader? No. A Hollywood movie star? None of those. Albert Einstein maybe? Who? No, none of those. No, not the president. Not at the time, the president was Harry S. Truman, but not. It wasn't Truman. Wasn't Churchill? No. So far, I haven't heard the right answer. So I'm just gonna stop. that was actually a quote from a speech given by General Omar Bradley. General Omar Bradley. And if you're not familiar with him, he was a 5-star general with the rank of General of the Army. He became very well known during World War II. Wikipedia, the online dictionary or online encyclopedia, sums up his service in World War II by saying, "From the Normandy landings through the end of the war in Europe, Bradley had command of all U.S. ground forces invading Germany from the west. He ultimately commanded 43 divisions and 1.3 million men, the largest body of American soldiers ever to serve under a U.S. field commander." In 1949, Bradley was appointed as the chairman of the Joint Chief of Staffs, which is the highest ranking military officer in the United States Armed Forces. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff serves as the principal military advisor to the President of the United States, to the National Security Council, today the Homeland Security Council, and the Secretary of Defense. So I think it's safe to say that General Omar Bradley, who died in 1981, I think it's safe to say that he was an expert on war, an expert. He learned it, he taught it, he lived it, he breathed it. It was his life. But reading that quote, it's also apparent that General Omar Bradley also knew something about man. I mean, he knew something about man. He knew that without God, man was almost sure to destroy himself through the mechanism of war. That's what that quote shows. So that's what my sermon is about today. War and our role in it as Christians. We'll see where war comes from and where it started. And we'll look at the obligations that we have as Christians when it comes to war. So let's begin by turning to the book of James, chapter 4. James chapter 4 will explore the seeds of war. James chapter 4. And under God's inspiration, these words were written. James 4, we'll begin in verse 1. Where do wars and fights come from among you? Do they not come from your desires for pleasure that war in your members? You lust and you do not have. You murder and covet and cannot obtain. You fight and war, yet you do not have because you do not ask. So there's the cause, or a key cause of war, that's identified here in these verses. Lust. Lust. And ultimately it's saying all wars begin with lust. And it can be many types of lust. Lust for power. Lust for authority. Lust for land. Lust for wealth. Lust for control. Lust for comfort. Lust for security. Lust for sex. And when you have a lust and you can't fulfill it, and we want it, we covet. We covet, and then eventually we end up taking it. You could look at every single war and trace its beginnings to a lust for something and a desire to obtain it. Let's keep reading in verse 2. You lust and do not have. You murder and covet and cannot obtain. You fight in war, yet you do not have because you do not ask. You ask and do not receive because you ask amiss that you may spend it on your pleasures. So James, he ties this lust and coveting in with rejection of God. Rejection of God. Instead of asking for things that God values, we reject those. We reject those things that God values, and we ask for things that give us pleasure instead. Verse 4. Adulterers and adulteresses, do you not know that friendship with the world is enmity with God? Whoever therefore wants to be a friend of the world makes himself an enemy of God. Or do you think that the scripture says in vain, the spirit who dwells in us yearns jealousy, but he gives more grace. Therefore he says, God resists the proud, but gives grace to the humble. Therefore, submit to God, resist the devil, and he will flee from you. So reading these verses, we can see that war is a thing of the flesh. It's not spiritual, at least not godly spiritual. It's a thing of the flesh. It's a symptom of desire and lust. In verse 7, James gives us the root cause of desire and lust. Satan, the devil. In verse 7, resist the devil. James says that if you submit to God, you will resist the devil and his lust and ultimately war. it's no accident that Satan is behind it. Satan has rebelled and been at war with God for a very long time. And he uses his influence and his power to turn people toward thoughts of hatred, thoughts of violence, and thoughts of war. And he's never going to stop doing this. He will never stop doing this. Let's turn to Revelation 20. We'll look at that. Revelation 20. And this is going to take place after Christ returns in Revelation 20 and puts Satan away for 1,000 years, stops his influence for 1,000 years. Revelation 20, verse 7. Now when those 1,000 years have expired, Satan will be released from his prison and will go out to deceive the nations which are in the four corners of the earth, Gog and Magog, to gather them together to battle, whose number is as the sand of the sea. They went up on the breadth of the earth and surrounded the camp of the saints in the beloved city. And fire came down from God out of heaven and devoured them. So here we have 1,000 years of peace on earth, Christ physically reigning, Satan put away, no influence, a perfect world. And do you think for that 1,000 years that Satan was going, you know what? You know, this looks pretty good. I'm going to repent of everything that I did, and I'm going to be a good guy now. No, you know, for that 1,000 years, he's sitting there stewing, plotting, scheming, and just hoping for the chance to get out. And what happens when he gets out? The first thing that he does, he incites lust. He puts his thoughts, he transmits his thoughts to those same things that lead to war. And he does it again. I mean, it's his nature. Now, Satan clearly did not want to submit to God, clearly. I mean, he would never. His dissatisfaction with God and God's way caused him to rebel in the first place, and he was going to be the cause of the last war. So when General Bradley uttered that line, America and most of the rest of the world had just been through the most horrific war up to that point of time. But as we can see by his words, while it was horrific, it was not unexpected. In fact, to us, to students of Christ, to us as disciples, it should be no surprise that there was a horrific war. General Bradley mentioned that man has rejected the Sermon on the Mount. Let's turn there to Matthew 24, to what is known as the Sermon on the Mount. In Matthew 24, we'll look at some of those things that he might have been referring to. Oh. Sorry. We're going to turn to Matthew 24. Verse 3. Now, as he said on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately saying, "Tell us, when will these things be, and what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age?" And Jesus answered and said to them, "Take heed that no one deceives you, for many will come in my name, saying, 'I am the Christ,' and will deceive many. And you will hear of wars and rumors of war. See that you are not troubled, for all these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet. For nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom, and there will be famines, pestilences, and earthquakes in various places. All these are the beginning of sorrows." Note that verse 6 says that there were wars and rumors of wars will be a hallmark of the end time. That's what it's going to be like in the end times. That's what Christ just told us, that that's what it was going to be like. They must happen, according to Christ, before the second coming. Now that the primary meaning of that word that's translated sorrows in verse 8 means birth pains or labor pains. And we know, well, at least we can surmise if we're men, we can't know that the with labor pains, the pains become closer together, more frequent and more painful the closer it gets to the end. And so we can make the conclusion that these wars and rumors of war likely will increase in intensity and pain for all of mankind as the time gets closer. Let's drop down to verse 21. For then there will be great tribulation, such as not been since the beginning of the world until this time, no, nor ever shall be. And unless those days were shortened, no flesh would be saved, but for the elect's sake, those days will be shortened. So it's saying if we were allowed to continue, what would happen? We would destroy ourselves, just as General Bradley suggested. Our lust, the lust of man in general, will, in the end times, become worse and worse. Those lusts will increase. They have to be increasing if wars are increasing. Satan's influence has to be increasing if wars are increasing. Let's turn to 2 Timothy chapter 3. And we'll look for proof of that. 2 Timothy chapter 3. We'll start in verse 1 of 2 Timothy 3. It says, "But know this, that in the last days perilous times will come." And we're in the last days. I mean, we are in the last days. "For men will be lovers of themselves, lovers of money, boasters, proud, blasphemers, disobedient to parents, unthankful, unholy, unloving, unforgiving, slanderers without self-control, brutal, despisers of good, traitors, headstrong, haughty, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God, having a form of godliness but denying its power, and from such people turn away." Now reading those descriptions, what is that but lust? But out of control lust for all those things we mentioned before, sex, power, control, all those things out of control. Is it any wonder that wars and rumors of wars will be increasing and intensifying in the end times? All those things listed, they lead not only to war, but first they lead to personal conflicts, conflicts between people. And then eventually, if not checked, to war. And we know that war, as waged by us, as waged by people, mankind in general, it's not a godly attribute. It's not. Modern war, as waged by man, is not holy. It's not good. It's not just. It's not right. It springs from our darkest parts, our deepest lust, and it has its roots in evil spirits. War equals death. You can't have a war without death and killing. And in any war, the people that do the killing are those who have some type of vested interest in that war. Those that are there for a reason. They're not innocent bystanders. They're not civilian casualties. They're there for a reason. And ultimately, that reason can be just about anything, and it's probably going to be a little bit different for everyone involved. But the people involved in the fighting of the wars are usually going to be the true believers, or those that are being commanded by the true believers. Soldiers, members of the military, whatever you want to call them, the ones that are the foot soldiers or the instruments of death and destruction that a government or a people will use to wage war. Now, I was a member of the United States military, the Air Force, from many of you know, from May of 1982 to May of 1986. And I joined the military not because I had a desire to kill, but out of a different desire, a desire to make money. At that time, for those of us that were there, the economy was in pretty bad shape. But the military under then President Reagan, he was building it up, talking it up. It was an attractive option. We remember those ads, you know, when it was depleted, you know, be all you can be, blah, 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 all those things. It was a viable option for young people. I knew I would be able to get training in computer repair and support my new bride, Diane, at the same time. So it was really an economic decision is what it boiled down to. Now, did I kill anyone while I was in the military? Well, not directly. I didn't go up and shoot anybody or anything like that. At least that I can remember. But indirectly, I was responsible for taking the lives of people. Indirectly, I was. Because in the fall of 1983, the island nation of Grenada was liberated by the forces of the United States military. And that included some elements of the Air Force. In this conflict in Grenada, 70 soldiers of Grenada and Cuba were killed. In addition, 24 civilians were killed, as well as 19 U.S. soldiers. So it was a conflict, an armed conflict, a battle that ended in the death of soldiers and civilians. Now, my job at that time was maintaining and repairing communications computers at a nuclear missile base in South Dakota, pretty far from Grenada. I was far from the action, and my job wasn't really directly connected with what was going on, but as part of that structure, as part of that force, I made it possible for this to happen. I did. And so I did have a hand in those deaths. I certainly did. And that means I was guilty of breaking the sixth commandment. Let's look at Matthew 5:21 to see why I was guilty of that. Matthew 5:21. Matthew chapter 5, verse 21 of Matthew 5. You have heard that it was said to those of old, you shall not murder, and whoever murders will be in danger of the judgment. But I say to you that whoever is angry with his brother without a cause shall be in danger of the judgment. And whoever says to his brother, Raca, shall be in danger of the council. But whoever says, you fool, shall be in danger of hell fire. In verse 21, God is referring to the sixth commandment. But in verse 22, he ties it in with the real cause, that lust that we discussed. The same lust that lead to war. In this particular example, he's talking about the lust of anger or whatever was motivating that anger, that lust against your brother. God doesn't separate those lusts out and say that one lust is better than another. The lust that I had was a desire to make money. If someone is in danger of Gehenna for anger at his brother, how much more danger was I in for doing it for simply money? How much more danger? I'd say it's pretty equivalent. Now, Jesus knows that in order to grow and overcome, that we have to conquer our lust. And at the time, I was not a Christian. So it could be said that I didn't know any better. And I have repented of my actions, and don't get me wrong either about this. I have great respect for the sacrifice that men and women of the military have made to do what they think is right, to defend our country and secure our freedom. But at the same time, we have to acknowledge that the vast majority of them have not been called by God. They have not. That's just reality. So they haven't been called. That means we shouldn't be hating them or calling them baby killers or any. I would hate to think that anybody would hate me for participating in the military when I didn't know any better. To God, what they're doing is no worse or no better than the sins of any other person, including ourselves, that we have committed or will commit. But my military service and my Christianity today, it brought up an interesting question. What if I were a Christian at the time that I was in the military? What if I were? And what if on that island of Grenada that day there was another Christian, a member of the Church of God, either themselves that were in the military or perhaps a Christian civilian? And what if they were one of those that were killed in the conflict? What would happen then? I would then be guilty of killing a brother in Christ for nothing more than a desire to make money. For nothing more than that desire. Now that might be, some might think that that's a simplification, a big simplification. And sure, you can say, well, there's other circumstances. Sure, I could find justification all day long. But that's when you boil it all down and strip everything away, that's what it boils down to. I joined an organization which, when it does its job, kills people and breaks things, to quote a famous radio personality. And I did it to earn money. That's the simple truth. So, as a Christian, knowing what I know now, I would not and could not join such an organization. And this is, in fact, one of the fundamental beliefs of the Church of God and of United Church of God in particular. Let me read that fundamental belief, and this is from the United Church of God website. And this was under the heading Military Service in War. And it says, "We believe that Christians are forbidden by the commandments of God from taking human life, directly or indirectly, and that bearing arms is contrary to this fundamental belief. Therefore, we believe that Christians should not voluntarily become engaged in military service. If they are involuntarily engaged in military service, we believe they should refuse conscientiously to bear arms, and to the extent possible, to refuse to come under military authority." So it's pretty clear. It says that Christians should not voluntarily become engaged in military service. And if we are, against our will, forced to belong to a military service, we should draw the line there. We should say, well, I'll go, but I'm not going to pick up a weapon. I'm not going to engage in activities that will directly or indirectly lead to the death of someone. In other words, we're supposed to do all we can do to avoid participating in any type of warfare. Now, of course, as we mentioned, one of the reasons for this is so that we don't take a human life. That's a big reason. We don't want to break the commandment. But there's another reason, and that reason is that it causes division in the Church of God. It has to. As a Christian, if I'm volunteering for my country to serve in the military, there's a really good chance that somewhere else in the world there's a country besides the United States. And there's a really good chance that in one of those countries that there's another Christian that lives in that country. And if they decided too that they were going to defend their country and join the military, there's a very good chance that we're going to be pitted against each other eventually, if it becomes the thought that it's perfectly okay. We might believe in our cause 100%. We might believe in our country, and we might believe that God's on our side. We might think that we're 100% right, 100% justified. But guess what? That guy on the other side, that Christian on the other side, he feels the exact same way. The exact same way. I find it very difficult to see where two people could ever be in agreement under such circumstances. How do you ever walk together as Christians under those circumstances? Here we are, both of us as Christians, advocating for the death of each other. And not just for them, but for the people on their side. That's the opposite of Christianity. As Christians, we're supposed to love each other despite cultural differences, despite country differences, despite government differences. We're supposed to love each other, not kill each other. But Christians are soldiers, in a sense. But we know our fight is not with the world or the people of the world. Let's turn to Ephesians chapter 6. Ephesians chapter 6. We're going to find out what our fight is, where our warfare is to be waged. Ephesians chapter 6, and we'll start in verse 10 of Ephesians 6. Finally, my brethren, be strong in the Lord and in the power of his might. Put on the whole armor of God that you may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil. For we do not wrestle against flesh and blood. That's not what we're fighting. We're not fighting these physical wars, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this age, against spiritual hosts of wickedness in the heavenly places. That's who our fight is with as Christians. That's who we're going to go to war against. As non-Christians, as people who aren't called by God, we could never see or realize that this is who the true enemy is. We wouldn't know. We can't know. As non-Christians, we're essentially defenseless. We can't defend ourselves against the real enemy. There's no defense. We don't even know the enemy's attacking us. There's just no defense if we don't know who the enemy is. That's why wars are becoming more frequent. That's why they will become more frequent. But as Christians, we know how to prepare ourselves against the real enemy. Let's continue in verse 13. Therefore, take up the whole armor of God, that you may be able to withstand in the evil day, and having done all, to stand. Stand, therefore, having girded your waist with truth, having put on the breastplate of righteousness, and having shod your feet with the preparation of the gospel of peace. Above all, taking the shield of faith with which you will be able to quench all the fiery darts of the wicked one. And take the helmet of salvation and the sword of the Spirit, which is the word of God, praying always with all prayer and supplication in the Spirit, being watchful to this end with all perseverance and supplication for all the saints. Those are the things. Those are the armors and the weapons that we use. We don't use hand grenades. We don't use guns. These are the weapons we use against the person who's attacking us, or the spiritual forces that are against us. Those physical armor and physical weapons, they can only help against physical foes, which in the long run aren't that important. They're really just pawns of the real enemy. Our fight isn't with these puppets that they're manipulating. Our fight is with the puppet master. That's where our battle lies. And serving in the army of God as a soldier of Christ, it really shouldn't leave that much time to engage in physical warfare. I mean, if we're fully engaged as Christians, we don't have time for that, to coin a phrase. Let's turn to 2 Timothy chapter 2 to look at that. 2 Timothy chapter 2, Paul talks about this. He gives an example of how involved we should be in our spiritual fight. 2 Timothy chapter 2, and we're going to start with verse 3. We'll read only verses 3 and 4 here. Talking to Christians, he says, "You therefore must endure hardship as a good soldier of Jesus Christ. No one engaged in warfare entangles himself with the affairs of this life, that he may please him who enlisted him as a soldier." So Paul is saying, a soldier in a physical war is way too busy to worry about the details of everyday life. And when you think about that situation, that's true. A soldier on the front lines, for example, he isn't going to say, "Well, hold on a minute, guys, I got a car payment to make. I'll be right back." No, I mean, he's completely engaged in that battle. It's kill or be killed. He's consumed, or she's consumed now, by the battle that they're in. And that should be the same way with us. We are in a real battle, and we're in the only battle that really counts, the only one. Why go through the trouble of trying to fight the symptoms, the physical wars, when we should be fighting our real foe, Satan? General Omar Bradley, we know, was a man of war. He was a man of war. It was his trade. It was his occupation. But despite this, or probably because of it, He knew full well the depravity and the fallen nature of man. He recognized it from being so familiar with war. He recognized how wretched we really are. Let's turn to Romans 3 to look at that depravity. Romans chapter 3. And we're going to read starting in verse 10 of Romans 3 and about the depravity of men. As it is written in verse 10, "There is none righteous, no, not one. There is none who understands. There is none who seeks after God. They have all turned aside. They have together become unprofitable. There is none who does good, no, not one. One, their throat is an open tomb. With their tongues they have practiced deceit. The poison of asp is under their lips, whose mouth is full of cursing and bitterness. Their feet are swift to shed blood. Destruction and misery are in their ways, and the way of peace they have not known. There is no fear of God before their eyes." This is a general description of man without God, of man without Christ. But we were called to be different than this. We were called to be different. We're called to live a life of example, a way of peace that most of the world doesn't know, and a way of life that to stay with that way of life, to stay with that way of peace, despite what the world throws at us. We're not called to fight physical wars. Jesus Christ himself said that that his kingdom is not of this world, or else he would fight. It's because if we're true Christians, we don't have those lusts, or we're working to eliminate those lusts and desires, those weapons of war that are needed to build up that that discontent, that unhappiness, that emptiness that leads to anger, lust, and violence. That shouldn't be us. Let's turn to 2 Corinthians chapter 10. And I wanted to turn there because there, Paul uses a description of how we should be living, or what our weapons are. 2 Corinthians chapter 10, and I'm going to start in verse 1. I'm going to read from the ISV, the International Standard Version, because I like the kind of the way it conveyed this idea better than the New King James. So I'm going to start in verse 1 of 2 Corinthians 10 from the ISV. It says, "Now I myself, Paul, plead with you with the gentleness and kindness of the Messiah. I, who am humble when I am face to face with you, but forceful toward you when I am away. I beg you that when I come, I will not need to be courageous by daring to oppose some people who think that we are living according to the flesh." Some people back then thought that we should be living according to the way of the flesh. "Of course, we are living in the world, but we do not wage war in a world-like way. For the weapons of our warfare are not those of the world. Instead, they have the power of God to demolish fortresses. We tear down arguments and every proud obstacle that is raised against the knowledge of God, taking every thought captive in order to obey the Messiah." Those are some pretty profound words when we boil them down here, because he's saying this is how we fight. You know, we don't sit there and punch someone in the nose. Instead, we use what God has given us to be obedient to Christ by spreading the gospel, by correcting when it needs to be corrected, by living basically our life as Christians. When he talks about tearing down arguments and every obstacle, every proud obstacle that is raised against the knowledge of God, he's talking about getting out there and preaching the gospel to give people knowledge of God. That's our goal. And that's how we fight. And we also fight by doing what God commands. Let's turn to 1 John chapter 5. 1 John chapter 5. This is going to be our final scripture. 1 John chapter 5. This is how we fight. This is how we fight. 1 John chapter 5, verse 2. "This is how we know that we love God's children. We love God and keep His commandments. For this demonstrates our love for God. We keep His commandments, and His commandments are not difficult, because everyone who is born from God has overcome the world. Our faith is the victory that overcomes the world." Brethren, we live in a fallen world where violence and war predominate. And it's not going to get better in the short term. It's not. It will get worse and worse the nearer it gets to Christ's return. And our victory won't be won in Europe. We won't have a VE Day equivalent, as was General Bradley's victory. It won't be won on a physical battlefield with death all around us. But our victory as Christians, our victory will be victory over the world and its ways. Victory over the world and its ways. And this victory is only possible one way, through Jesus Christ.